Turn on the recorder. You should receive the notification that we're going to start recording.
I said continue.
Okay, so we're live. I'm gonna start at the very beginning. I know you were born in 1935. But I don't know where. I was assuming Canada.
I was born in Montreal in 1935. Exactly correct.
Okay. And can you tell me a little bit about your family? Do you have
I have a rather colorful family. This is not a big secret, so I'll tell you about it. I grew up in 1935, so I was born in the middle of the Depression. My family was never seriously inconvenienced by the Depression, as far as I could understand it. We always lived in a kind of an upper middle class neighborhood. My mother didn't work, but I'm a twin. The only reason that may even be relevant is my brother, at one time when I was president here at Princeton, he was president of McGill University in Montreal. So that was kind of fun. But in any case, we had a kind of normal upper middle class upbringing, you might say. My father was a rather, I don't know quite how I'll describe it the best I can. He was, he originally immigrated to the U.S. He came to Canada, I think, just ahead of the FBI because he'd gotten himself into the bootlegging business in some way. I'm not sure exactly what way. He was never very clear about that. But it's quite clear to me that he didn't just arrive in Canada because he suddenly decided he'd like colder weather or something like that. He came here because it was, I think, one step ahead of whoever was trying to impose the bootlegging restrictions of various kinds. And he came, he settled in Montreal, continued to have various kinds of business, sometimes on the right side of the law, sometimes on the wrong side of the law. I'm not sure of all the details. He wasn't clear. I know he did everything from continuing some of the bootlegging business to being a bookie of various kinds and stuff like that. So he was he was 20 years older than my mother, so it was a little unusual marriage. And so he eventually, however, in the post-Second World War period, settled down into the restaurant business. And that was when I was 10 or 11 years old. And so by the time I really got to know him, that part of his life was behind him. But he was sort of well-known in the community. That was who he was. It wasn't this was a big secret. That was a kind of unusual aspect of my experience as a young person.
You mentioned your mother. Was she Canadian? Did they meet?
My mother was born in Canada. Her parents had immigrated maybe a year or two before she was. So it's her parents were immigrants. My father was an immigrant from Odessa. And he got his first job. He's a tinsmith, a metal worker. He immigrated and moved to Toledo, Ohio, where the automobile plants were. And he got his first job. He was actually in the automobile assembly line of the Willis Overland Company, who eventually produced the Jeep, but not at that time, because this was back in the teens. And so I don't know how much about him you want to know is relevant here. He had been married in Odessa, had a wife and two children. The plan was to bring them here when he'd saved up some money. However, the World War I interrupted, and two of his three family members died either of starvation or the flu in 1918. And he eventually brought his daughter from that marriage to Canada eventually. And so I have a kind of half sister and who came and he settled in Montreal in the kind of giving you a very loose description of what he was doing. I can, if you have any interest, I could say more about that. But I really grew up in what I would consider, first of all, I grew up inside the Jewish community, right? In those years in Montreal, the religious communities are really quite separate. The Catholics, the Protestants, the Jews, tend to live near each other. So in my area of Montreal, and I grew up, There was no French-speaking people at all in the area. There were a lot of English-speaking people, mainly Protestant Dennis, and a sizable Jewish community. But these communities were quite separate. My early experiences were that these were quite separate things. I, you know, interacted with kids on the street regardless of who they were. But, you know, going to each other's homes was another thing altogether. These were, I don't think I was ever in another person, in a home of either a Protestant or Catholic member of the community. The Catholics were not very present in my area because they were mainly French speaking. And I was in an English, I lived in an English speaking area of Montreal. So, you know, I grew up, I started going to public school when I was in first, second, third, fourth grade. And in the fifth grade, for my parents decided to enroll me in a all-male school, private school. I went there as a day school student. I wasn't a boarder. I stayed there till I went to college.
And so that was roughly 1945. 52.
No, I was born in 35, so it was roughly, it was exactly 1952 when I entered McGill University. But
I meant when you were in fifth grade and went to the private
school. Yeah, that was roughly 45, right, 45. Maybe 44, 45, something like that.
I was just going to ask, do you have any recollections about life in Canada during the World War? Was there rationing going on? I'm just unfamiliar.
You know, you knew there was a war going on. But it was really mainly protected from that in some sense. My parents didn't talk about it. Of course, I mean, on the street, the kids were talking about it all the time. We'd have mock battles between this side and that side. Various games were played. And, you know, my mother was a warden. We had air raid drills, as if somehow the German bombers were going to be over Montreal. And everyone had to turn the lights off. My mother would walk around the street making sure all the lights were out in the various houses and so on. So, but in reality, you know, I saw soldiers on the street. I had only two relatives in the army. They were actually in the armed forces, one of whom died in Europe. And, but for the most part, the war had little impact on my life. I can remember in first grade where we all supposed to draw pictures and put them up on the wall in the hallway for parents to come and see. Almost all of them were war pictures, you know, battleships or airplanes and stuff. But in the reality, there was, for example, in Montreal, and I presume the same thing was true here, there was pretty strict rationing of certain kinds of things, rationing of gasoline, rationing of sugar, rationing of butter, rationing of meat, and so on. However, as an economist would know, there are markets and there are markets. So my mother had an arrangement with her butcher. She gave him all the meat coupons, and he gave her whatever she wanted. I think she didn't ask too much what the price was, you know. So there were, you know, so I was privileged in that way. I didn't really experience the only thing I can remember that of a privation sense during World War II when I was, you know, between 5 and 10 years old. I badly wanted a bike with chrome handlebars. But during the war, you couldn't get chrome. At least in Canada, you couldn't get them on bicycles. So they had some kind of other metal, sort of black-looking, I don't know what it was, steel or something, that I had. And that bothered me until I got to college. I always wanted to change my bike. My parents said, one bike's enough. You don't need another one. And so I never got a bike with chrome handlebars. So it was at that level of deprivation. I mean, I'm trying to just express it was like zero. So I didn't really experience the war in that respect.
And just out of curiosity, do you remember hearing about America's use of the atomic bomb on Japan?
Well, yeah, at that time I certainly heard about it. But in my experience, it was overwhelmed by VE and VJ, so-called VE Day and VJ Day.
Right.
I mean, for my parents, that was the overwhelming thing. The atomic bomb was I don't think they even understood it, frankly, understood just what it was and what its implications were. And as you can guess, a very large part of my family, my parents' families perished during the war. So probably 80% Their families perished in the war. That was the issue that they, that emotionally was present in the house. The A-bomb was something, first of all, my parents didn't understand, didn't know what it was in the sense that we would think about it today. And I don't even recall a single conversation. You know, Roosevelt and Truman were heroes, and so was Churchill and all the other people who were on the Allied side. And that was what dominated the conversation. I don't think I thought about the A-bomb carefully till I was, you know, late 1940s, early 1950s. When I say carefully, at least I had some knowledge of what the issues were here.
Yeah. So being in the Jewish community, being Jewish yourself, yeah, were there discussions about the Holocaust?
Well, this varied a lot household to household. I don't think in our household, that we had one serious conversation about it. Okay. I picked it up mainly from friends where this was an everyday conversation in their houses. So I picked it up that way. My parents, I'm inferring now, had the philosophy that, you know, you don't need to know about that. I don't know what their philosophy was exactly, but I don't recall a single conversation. And but on the street, or by that I mean with the people I knew in the community, it was a conversation every day in many of their houses. And I don't know just what my parents had in mind in this respect, whether they were trying to shield me from all that kind of difficulty. And I think that probably was their view. But I don't know. I really don't know. I never really pursued it with them.
You mentioned your twin brother. Is he identical or fraternal?
An identical twin.
Identical twin.
Yeah.
And did your parents have any other kids after you?
No. No, I had his half-sister, which my father had from his first marriage. But she really was more like an aunt. She was really my mother's age. Mm-hmm. And so while she was my sister, I thought of her really as an aunt and treated her that way. We were really in different generation.
So what were some of the things that you, and I'm assuming you did a lot with your brother when you were younger, what were some of the things that you and your brother did when you weren't in school? Let's get to about fifth grade or so.
Yeah, well, in fact, we were not alike at all in that way.
Oh.
We didn't do things together. We shared a room, you know. Housing standards were different in 1940s than they are right now. So we shared a room the whole time we were at home, and we went to college at home. So we lived at home during college. But my brother and I had completely different interests when we were growing up. I had a great interest in, like many other men and nowadays women, I had a great interest in athletics. I played in my high school football team, a basketball team. I was on the swim team. I was always engaged very heavily in athletics. My brother hated athletics. He didn't like watching it and didn't like participating. And it's the same today. I mean, we're now in our mid-80s. He's still the same way. I never call him and ask him, do you see the baseball game? He never watches a baseball game or a tennis match or something. So in fact, although, as I said a moment ago, we shared a room, we didn't really share a life. I mean, in those days, everybody, you know, families ate together in the evening usually. So we did that every night. So we were together. And of course, we were sleeping in the same room. But we had different friends, different interests. My brother stayed at home much more than I did. So we really were very different. And our friends in Montreal, who are still friends with today, just can't get over that we ended up somehow being very similar, doing very similar things, because in those days they always distinguished us between the kinds of things I did and the kinds of things that my brother did. So obviously we got more alike as life moved on, but in those days we were not together at all. I mean, hardly at all.
But you were both sent to the same private school?
Went to the same private school. We were usually in a different classroom. It was a small school, so sometimes there weren't enough students to have two separate classrooms. But sometimes, if there were two classes of the same grade, we were in separate classrooms. you know, it was a school which was imagining itself as maybe being one day the Eton of Canada. Of course, it never even closely got to that level. But they had very many British customs they followed. It was a cricket team. You know, they called you by your last name in class. You know, whatever your last name was, they called it. So Caruso, they'd call you. They wouldn't call you David. And so then they had this problem. What were they going to call my brother and I? And so they usually picked, they had some scheme like either Shapiro 1, Shapiro 2, Shapiro 8, Shapiro B. Each year it sort of changed a little bit, but they never did go to first names of anybody in the school. So that was kind of just a funny, you know, funny affect or something that they followed.
You also mentioned that your family started, your father started the restaurant business. Was it just one restaurant or was it a chain?
Well, it started off as one restaurant in 1945, 46. I'm not sure exactly what the year is, 45, 46. Eventually, when this blossomed out a bit, they had one major restaurant. And they had another restaurant, which was something of the 1950s, which I know this is kind of one of these drive-in restaurants where you drove up and they brought a tray outside and served. We had one of those, but that was much smaller than the main restaurant that they built. Yeah.
Was there a specific type of cuisine?
Well, that's another kind of odd thing. Maybe it was actually a very successful restaurant. Financially successful. And it had two different kitchens. It had a kitchen that prepared Chinese food and a kitchen that prepared, I don't know whether you call it American food or not, you know, steaks, lobster, roast beef, et cetera, that kind of stuff that people ate. And at lunchtime, you can only get from what we call the American kitchen, which was just what I've described, various kinds of things. And so it was very unusual in that respect. Since I haven't seen many people copy it, I guess most people thought that wasn't the best thing to do. But it was really very successful. It was just after the war. People had a lot of money. People had cars for the first time. And one of the distinguishing aspects of this restaurant is we had a huge parking lot. We were located just outside of downtown. And we had probably put 300 cars in our parking lot. And the seating in the restaurant was upwards of 700. So it was a very big restaurant. And in its day, it was very successful from a financial point of view.
I know friends, colleagues who grew up with parents in the restaurant industry. Mm-hmm. And they also essentially lived at the restaurant, at least in the early years before places got off the ground. Were you spending much time at the restaurant, or was that just your father went there, he came home?
We didn't spend any time there until we got to our late years in high school, where she used to work there during the summer doing, and first starting with sort of menial jobs of various kinds. And then when we were in college, we continued to work there during the summertime doing somewhat more advanced kind of work there. But so, yeah, we worked quite a bit there, but not during school. When school was in session, we didn't work there. My mother was very, very insistent on that. She was always worried you wouldn't study hard enough. So we weren't allowed to work or more or less do anything during the time when school was in session.
So education was extremely important to your family?
Education was very important to my mother, and my father went along with it. I don't know. He thought he did very well without an education. I mean, he was orphaned when he was, I think, 7 or 8 years old, and came from an extremely poor background. And as you mentioned, he eventually became a metal worker. But my mother was important, but she really didn't know much about education. She had left high school when she was about, well, I think we'd think the 10th grade or something like that. Did not graduate from high school because she had to go to work to support her parents and sisters and brothers. She was one of six. Mm-hmm. So, but my mother, for whatever reason, education was very important to her. And indeed, although this will sound very funny, if not very odd, my mother wouldn't get a television set in our house till I graduated from college, feeling that, you know, I might get hooked on television and not spend enough time working. It sort of sounds very peculiar when I say it right now, but so she knew that it was important. She didn't, I mean, she had, neither her or my family had any idea really what a university was. They knew you had to go to university to be a doctor or a lawyer or something like that. They knew that, but they didn't know what it was like. When my brother and I graduated from high school, we were offered scholarships to various universities in the U.S., two or three universities. My parents thought this was the oddest possible thing. It was a perfectly good university, a bus ride away, and that's where we were going. And, you know, and I didn't know much better myself at the time, honestly. Hmm. And so I and all my friends went to the same, you all went to McGill University. And that was just the way it seemed very natural at the time.
Okay. You'd mentioned your interest in sports mm-hmm. and athletics. Were there any subjects in school? Well, actually, let me, before I ask about school, did you have any other hobbies as a kid or teenager? Were you playing with chemistry sets? Were you looking for gold in the backyard? Did you go out and do bird watching? Did you have any other sorts of hobbies while you were growing up?
No, I didn't. Frankly speaking, looking back, I must have been one of the most inane 17-year-olds that ever arrived. I mean, it's the honest truth. I didn't have any notion of what I was going to do. I didn't have any special interests in science, let's just say, or any other subject I could think of. I went to school, did my work, did well at school, but I didn't really have any interest of that kind, as I mentioned earlier before, to the extent I had spare time. So when I was older, like when I was 15, 16, 17, I spent, an hour or two a day in the pool, either playing water polo or training. And I was a mediocre water polo player and a mediocre swimmer, but, you know, that's what I was doing, and I enjoyed it. And but the truth is, I had no idea what I was doing when I entered university. No idea. I didn't know what was going to be expected of me. I didn't know where it was leading. My father suggested to me that I take economics. I think he thought that was somewhat close to business or something like that, and it might help me in that area. And so I did do that. My interest really in what we might consider the broader world, even in a very simple way, really began when it began in two things. When I entered McGill and started taking my first courses and realized that, hey, this is a world that I hadn't even thought about. So that was very important. And while this will sound very corny to you, I'm quite sure, I met the young girl at that time. She was 15, that eventually became my wife, and she was still living together. And the very first time we went out together, she asked me what I was going to do. Of course, I hadn't the slightest idea. I don't think I'd ever thought about the question. I was just sort of moved. And she said, well, you should know what you're going to do. And I know what I'm going to do, she says. She announced as a 15-year-old. And she did what she said. I mean, she actually did what she said at that time. And the truth is that it was really under her influence more than anyone else that got me to be serious about what I was doing and to take myself seriously and to take my work seriously. And to I changed a lot between when I entered McGill fall of 52 and by the following year. And just to give you an idea about that, this is a kind of funny story about twins. So I did well in my freshman year, and in my sophomore year, I did well enough to earn a scholarship. So I got a letter in the mail sometime during the summer from someone at McGill University says, congratulations on doing so well. We'll give you a scholarship for the next 2 years at the university, my following 2 years. So I know I was very excited. When I told my mother, her reaction was, they must have meant your brother. This must be a mistake. You're twins. You're not in that category of studying carefully and so on. And she was right. I mean, that was not an unnatural. I mean, I was a little deflated at the time. But I mean, when I thought about it carefully, that's right. She could have expected my brother to be in that category and not expect me to be in that category. So it was a big change in my life took place when I was in freshman, sophomore years.
So I do want to hear about the changes, the courses that you were taking. But before I go on, I need to know. So what is it that your wife had, before she was your wife, what is it that she
could her do? Idea was to become a social worker and help families.
Okay.
Because she wanted to help young children and families. And in fact, even after, through her PhD and everything else, she focused on helping young meaning less than 5 years old, sometimes less than 2 years old, helping families dealing with children. And so she worked on that her whole life, did a lot of research on that, wrote on it, wrote a book about that, etc. So she knew and stuck to it all those years.
Okay. Thank you for that. Now, you mentioned that, entering McGill, it was an important transition for you. I know that you graduated with a degree in communications.
No, in commerce.
Oh, commerce. Okay.
That's a business degree, essentially. Okay. McGill called it commerce at that time. I don't think they do anymore.
Okay. So what you mentioned, your father recommended taking economics.
Yeah.
What other classes were you taking when you started?
Well, he had a very particular recommendation. He thought I should become an accountant. Mm-hmm. So I took a lot of courses in my first 3 years, especially in accounting, because I thought the idea for my family was I would do this accounting, then I would serve some apprenticeship in an accountant's office, what they did in those days, and then write exams and become an accountant. But two things happened in these first 2 years, two kinds of things happened. In the first 2 years, and in the third year, something more important. That is, the first course I took was a course in economic history, kind of a survey course that went from ancient Egyptian and classical times to the present, given at that time by the president of the university, actually gave the course. Mm-hmm. And it was a big introductory, 300-person or 400-person course. But I found it absolutely fascinating. I had never thought about history in that way. I'd never thought about just how it impacted. And it really, that course and others as time went on, got me to think correctly that I'd had a very narrow view of what the possibilities were and to express one's humanity and so on. And that there was, the standard kind of thing many people say, that your eyes began to open. And so I began taking courses that were not in the what we would call the business school. Began taking courses elsewhere. Then by the time I got to be a junior, my wife was then to-be wife was a freshman. And she was taking a whole different kind of course. She was studying Western intellectual history and other things of that nature, philosophy and so on. She had was interested in Latin for a while. And I began attending her courses in addition to my courses. Well, because it was one way to see her. And so we would go to the same course. She never attended any of mine. She had no interest in the ones that I was doing. But I attended her courses in various kinds of things in the humanities. And I really got hooked on some of these things. And by the time I was a senior, I was clear I was not going to be an accountant. I didn't want to do that. But then at that same time, I guess it's an appropriate point to say it, my father got ill when I was in the senior year, and it was pretty clear that he was not going to survive very long. And so my brother and I really had to take over his business at that time, which was mainly the restaurant business. And so by the time I graduated, I knew I wasn't going to do anything except sort of try to see what I could do with my father's business and make postpone any further decisions regarding my career. So that's why, in my case, I had a kind of 4 to 5 year interval where my brother and I were running this restaurant, which we eventually sold because we wanted to go back to school.
So just to ask, prior to your father's health declining, did you have a vision for what it is you wanted to be as your next step from college? Like, no?
I knew I wanted to do something else. I knew I hadn't picked a profession by that time. I hadn't said I want to be an economist or I want to be this or that. It was the most obvious thing to do was become an economist because I'd taken a lot of courses in economics. And so that was one of the possibilities. But by the time of, I wouldn't say as a graduating senior, but by 2 years later, I knew that I wanted to go back to school and I wanted to become a professor if I could. Now, I didn't know anybody who was a professor. Nobody in my family knew anybody who was a professor. It sounded very like a good idea to them in principle, but it didn't sound to them as good as having a good business, for example. So my family were not against it. By family, I mean now my mother and her brothers, essentially, because my father by that time had passed away. But they, you know, there wasn't a serious objection. The only objection they had, because my wife and I got married a year after I graduated, so she was still in, she was a junior at that time in college. And by the time this, you know, I'm in business a few years and so on, we already had two children. So I had, in thinking about going to school, going back to school, I had a family already to take care of and help take care of. And so fortunately, when I sold my business, we sold our business, I should say, you know, I had some money left over. We sold it. It seemed to me like a lot of money in those times, but just to give, it was enough to support me during graduate school. That's essentially what it was. And so when I decided where in graduate school, I'd already had a lot of economics. I said, well, all right, that sounds as good as anything. Let me try to do graduate work in economics. Sad to say, it wasn't any deeper feeling or understanding than that. It was just a very practical thing to do. I didn't know much about university life. This seemed to give me a start. I was good at mathematics, or at least I had been good at mathematics when I was in college. And so I said, well, okay, we'll try economics. I mean, sad to say, this is a very haphazard way to get anywhere, but that's the reality. It was a very haphazard, I wouldn't say casual, because that would mean I didn't care. I did care, and I cared about where I went. I can tell you where I went to graduate school. I can tell you an amusing story about that, if it doesn't take up too much of your time. I didn't know where to go to graduate school. You know, I'd heard of Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Chicago, the places everybody has heard about. So I thought, well, okay, I could start there. I didn't know whether I would qualify for admission or anything. So I applied to Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Chicago, not having the slightest idea which one I should go to. And it turned out I was admitted. This is already 1960 or so. Things weren't quite as competitive as they are today. I got admitted to all these places, but didn't know what to do. So I went, I did have a friend whose uncle was chairman of the Bank of Canada, which is like the Federal Reserve in Canada, right, head of the central bank. So he said, well, my uncle's an economist, why don't you go speak to him? So I went up to Ottawa, spoke to this person, Mr. Resminski at the time, and he said, well, Jacob Viner is at Princeton, so I suggest you go there. And I said, okay, and that's where I went. I arrive at Princeton the first day. So the first thing I want to do is go see Professor Viner. I find out where his office is. I go to the office. The office is empty. And there's piles of books outside his office lying down the hallway. So I go to the secretary, the general office, and where is Professor Viner? Oh, he just retired. And I said, well, who's going to replace him? She says, you have to ask Professor so-and-so. I went and asked. He said, oh, well, we're not replacing him. We don't think this is the area that we need, that this department is devoted to. I was going to study the history of economic thought. Mm-hmm. So I was assigned an advisor, a Professor Quant, who I see the first day I'm down at Princeton. He looks over my transcript from undergraduate work and says, well, he said, our graduate program has no requirements. After you take some courses, and when you're ready, you show up for your general examination. He says, looking at your transcript here, you've taken enough economics, but you haven't taken enough mathematics. My suggestion is you go take some courses in mathematics and take whatever courses of economics you like, but the mathematics is really key. So I did. I spent most of the next 2 years in the mathematics department taking essentially junior and senior courses in mathematics, occasional graduate seminar. And then I presented myself for the exams, passed the exams, and I was, you know, I had my thesis to do, but I was done. So this whole thing always, in retrospect, seems very haphazard to me. You know, I just sort of almost stumbled from one thing to another, but by that time, at least I knew what I wanted to do. I knew I was heading somewhere. And so it's a kind of funny combination of circumstances.
Yeah, so some follow-up questions, if you don't mind. One thing I tend to ask individuals about, you didn't mention it, so it may be of no significance. Did you have an awareness of or response to the launch of Sputnik in the late 50s?
Yeah. Well, I was excited about it. I can't say that I had that it sort of changed anything in my life, but I mean, I was aware of it and people were proud of it. That was at exactly the time when my father also became ill. And so this was my recollection, which is probably not right, as I first actually saw the paper when my father was in the hospital. That maybe I confused the sequence of things there. I'm not sure. But yeah, certainly I remember that, and that was exciting.
Okay.
It didn't excite me in the sense that I want to be a scientist in that sense.
Mm-hmm. It's just, again, I've interviewed a lot of U.S. scientists, not as many from Canada. Yeah. And even, you know, just talking about it, you know, the American context, it's this communist threat,
right? Like, so,
right. I'm curious to get other perspectives on that same event. Yeah. You also mentioned that you had two kids, right? And your wife had finished her degree. So this is before going to Princeton, right? Two kids. And
well, certainly I had, you know, just as, let me go backtrack about Sputnik. I think Canadians were a lot less invested in the Soviet U.S. Kind of competition. Mm-hmm. So yes, they would rather the Americans do it than the Soviets do it. But nevertheless, this wasn't such a big deal. Canada, as you know, was not a player in this sense. They weren't going to do the satellite themselves. They didn't have the capacity to do that. So, you know, same thing happened with respect to something like the Korean War. Mm-hmm. Korean War was, you know, Canadians were by and large supportive of the Americans. But, you know, that was some other countries doing this. Canadians actually did send soldiers to Korea, as it turned, as you probably know, but it wasn't, you know, a national fixation. This was a kind of a side issue for the most part, I think.
Yeah. I guess part of my curiosity is with Canada being adjacent to a country that seemed like it might be starting or potentially starting a nuclear war.
Yeah.
You know, with those types of weapons, you don't even really want to be next.
Anywhere.
Yeah.
That's right. You don't want to be anywhere. Yeah. You know, you're absolutely correct. I mean, this is a huge, nuclear weapons are a huge thing. It's still today a huge a huge thing. Nuclear, whether it's nuclear proliferation or whatever, it's a huge thing. But I have to say that, and it was part of the naivety of my own upbringing, that, you know, I didn't pay much emotional attention to that. It wasn't sort of emotionally taxing to me. I think it's probably because I was just simply very unsophisticated or something. And it didn't, you know, I wasn't a scientist. I wasn't intending to be a scientist. It, you know, I have to say, not very proud to say that it just sort of was in the background there. And, you know, I didn't really relate to it in any emotional way, which is a very sad comment, actually. But there it is.
Well, you were also, you know, trying to run a family business. You had a young family. There was a lot going on in your life.
Yeah. And oh, yeah.
It was the bigger things, you know, if they weren't directly relevant to you, you note them, but you don't necessarily fixate on them because you have other things happening.
Yeah. I just wanted to point out that my wife, graduate education, sort of developed over time. Mm-hmm. We had this very young family. We were moving to Princeton. So she kind of slowly accumulated what was necessary to get her advanced degrees, but it didn't happen in kind of as rapid a sense. You know, it took me, 3 years to get my PhD. Mm-hmm. And it took her quite a bit longer because whether that's appropriate or not appropriate in today's context, she was really carrying. By the time I started my first lectures at Michigan, we had 4 children. So we had a big family and a lot to do. And I have to say a lot of the effort fell on her shoulders.
Yeah. So that's what I was actually going to ask was, knowing that she did pursue her degree, I wasn't sure if she was applying to graduate programs or she had planned to take classes at whatever location the two of you went.
Yeah, that's right. It was in that way is probably very different from the conversations that would happen today. Amongst a couple, at least as I imagine it, or as I watch my children have those conversations. So yeah, it was very different. It was clear in our minds that, you know, I was deciding what I was going to do, and then the rest we'd fill in as best we could. And so in that way, you know, she had a lot of challenges to overcome.
And were there any concerns for you or for your wife in terms of moving to the United States? It sounded like you grew up in Montreal. I don't know if your family traveled
much. So many things. Yeah, we did travel. I mean, in my generation, or in my neighborhood where I grew up and where I went to school, I was the first one of my friends to go to travel to Europe, travel to California. So I was very fortunate in that respect. And so we did, you know, I did a lot of traveling with my family, went to South America, went to Europe twice, et cetera. And so that all happened before I was out of high school. So that was unusual at the time. These things are very common nowadays, but I mean, it was unusual at the time. So things were different. So, yeah.
Okay. When you arrived at Princeton, how many other individuals were in your entering class in the department?
Very small. I think, I can't remember, it was like 10, let's say.
Okay.
Was
it predominantly men? Any women in the economics?
It was all men.
Okay.
Princeton's co-education started in their graduate programs, but that started just after I was there. It started, in fact, the last year I was at Princeton, 63-64, there was, I think, 1 or 2 women graduate students around out of a pretty large number to overall. But it was a completely male environment in every bad way you can think about it at that time. So, and my wife did not at all like it at Princeton. She thought it was much too conservative, the kids were too conservative, the whole town was too conservative, and she was right. So she felt like it was a breath of fresh air when we moved to Michigan. She just felt it was a whole different environment. She was very glad to get out of here. And I have to say, I won't go to there now, but she was reluctant to come back for exactly the reasons, these kind of
reasons. For those early experiences.
Yeah.
When you entered Princeton, you had the Harold Helm Fellow. Was that an automatic thing for anyone entering Princeton?
No, it wasn't automatic. I didn't know about it, but I got, those were the years I was just too naive. I won fellowships every year. It was at Princeton, but I always gave the money back because I had money left over from a sale of the restaurant, and I felt I shouldn't take that money if other students could use it who didn't have money to go to graduate school. So I won fellowships every year, but I never took any of the money. That I don't know if anyone ever does that anymore, or if anyone did it then. I can't. Most people couldn't even think about it. But I mean, I was in that fortunate position. And of course, tuitions, as you all know, were very different then than they are today.
Right. So how was it managing time as a graduate student with also having a young family?
Very difficult. I have to say, I'm a hard worker anyways, but I worked very hard. Finishing in 3 years wasn't easy, but I was very motivated because I had a family and I had to get settled and I couldn't be around graduate school indefinitely. And so I was extremely motivated to finish quickly. Princeton, as I mentioned before, had no specific requirements other than the general examinations and the PhD. So I just moved as quickly as I could. And I think I wrote my thesis in 9 months, something like that. So I was lucky. I picked a topic that worked. I mean, you can pick a topic that doesn't work. I picked a topic that could work, and that was just, I think, lucky, really. And so I was very glad to get out of here. I liked Princeton, I mean, when I was here, but I was glad to finish and get on to having some kind of regular job. But, you know, you mentioned, why am I in the U.S. instead of Canada? We had no intention of coming to the U.S. Our idea was we're going to go back to Montreal where our family was, or maybe we go to Toronto, maybe we go to Ottawa, And in those days, universities everywhere were growing. It was very easy to get jobs, very, very different than today. Mm-hmm. So every one of my colleagues in my class at Princeton could choose at least between two or three different jobs, which they thought were useful for them. You might be interested in this story. I had no concept I was going to be in the U.S. I had interviewed at the Bank of Canada, I interviewed at the University of Toronto, I interviewed at McGill University, all of whom had jobs and all of whom offered me a job. And I was walking across the Princeton campus one day and my thesis advisor stops me and says, Professor Smith, his actual name was Smith, from the University of Michigan is here interviewing people and would you like to interview him? He's here from the University of Michigan. I said, no, I'm not going the first mission. I'm going back to Canada. He said, well, the problem is that I told him you would interview him. So I said, well, okay, I'll be glad to go to the interview, but I'm going to be honest. If he asks me the question, I'm going to tell him what I feel. And corny as it sounds, this guy seduced me into coming to the University of Michigan. I mean, that's just the reality. I mean, I'm a little embarrassed to say it after all these years, but my colleagues in Canada and the universities, I was working in quantitative economics, building very large statistical models of economic systems. My colleagues in McGill, for example, the same thing at the University of Toronto, said, well, all right, we don't do that work here, but if you want to do it, that's fine. But first, you've got to come and do some teaching in principles, et cetera, do some things that the department needs, not an unreasonable attitude. And later on, you'll get to teach or work in that area. Professor Smith from the University of Michigan asked me what I was working on. He says, we need people working in that area. He says, come to Michigan, you can work in that area. We'll figure out who's going to teach principals and so on later on. But right now, you want to work in that area? This is what we want. We're looking for that. So I came home and I said to my wife, well, look, neither of us ever been to Ann Arbor. We hadn't the slightest idea. You know, we didn't know anything about the University of Michigan. and said, well, look, we can go there for 3 years. We don't like it. We can go to Canada then. In the meantime, I can get my work started. And that's how we went to the University of Michigan. We had no idea even when we went that we were going to stay. But it turned out when we went there, we obviously it turned out we liked it. I mean, mm-hmm. we liked Ann Arbor very much. We thought it was a great town and we liked living there. And so one thing led to another. Never did go back.
Since I'm unfamiliar with, especially the area of economics that you were interested in, when you talk about large modeling, were you running calculations with that mm-hmm. model? Is this something?
They were forecasting models.
Okay, and so what I wanted to ask was, were you then also using early computational systems, computers, yes, in
absolutely.
Order.
Absolutely.
So like punch card systems and...
Oh, well, I'll tell you, I'm sorry to talk so much.
No, I love it when you talk.
I'll tell you a story about my first... You probably don't know anybody that ever programmed an IBM 650. You're much too young to have known anybody. Your father probably didn't know anyone who ever did this. So I'm walking, this is 1954, so I'm between my sophomore and junior year. And I see a sign on the notice board, a computer programmer wanted $10 an hour, summer employment, something roughly like that. I had no idea what a computer programmer was. I didn't know what a computer was. But I saw $10 an hour. And I said, well, I'm going to investigate it. They gave you you had to come somewhere at a certain time. It turned out that when we got to this place, there were three or four others looking for this job also. And we were given an examination. The examination was on differential equations. Hmm. I had just taken a course in differential equations weeks ago. Not only that, the examination they gave us was the exact same examination I had gotten in my differential equations course. The exact same. The professor hadn't bothered to make up another examination. So, of course, I didn't, by that time, I knew the answers to all the questions because the ones I didn't get on the exam, I'd gotten over, you know, I figured out later on. And so I sat down there and I couldn't believe what I was looking at. But I did the exam. When I finished, I was embarrassed to say I finished because everyone else was working hard on these problems. I was embarrassed to get up and hand the paper and they would think, I don't know what they would think, but I was embarrassed to do that. So I spent as much time as I could pretending to go back and review my questions and so on. And eventually I handed the exam in. And not surprisingly, for completely irrelevant reasons, I got the job. I went down to the first day in the job. I walk in this big room. I mean, the IBM 650 took up a small size, the entire, I mean, what it had less power than our iPhone, but I mean, it took up a pretty good sized room, another different instruments. And they give me a pile of manuals and say, okay, start reading. You're going to be our chief operator during the daytime this summer. And so I had to teach myself programming from the start. I didn't even know what programming was. And in those days, you didn't have any of these fancy languages that you have now. We had to program machine language, so you really was very, very primitive language. Didn't even have Fortran, which is now considered a very old-fashioned language. I had to just teach myself, and I spent the entire summer, most of it is learning how to, you had to start the machine in the morning. It was like starting an aircraft carrier or something. You had to start moving all kinds of things around and so on. And you had to go down a list, like they say pilots do, you know, they talk, I'm not a pilot, I don't know, but I understand pilot. That's what we had. We had a list. We were blowing fuses all the time because we didn't know exactly what we were doing. But I got through the summer, I learned programming. Mm-hmm. And I've always regretted that I never followed up on that surprising and completely surprising start. Because I had no idea what was about to happen in the computer world. I had no concept that here I was with these. It's all still vacuum tubes. There were no transistors or anything in these machines.
Yeah.
So I think I probably I know I'm the only one in Princeton because I've asked. They know of people in their distant past who they think may have programmed an IBM 650, but no one here has actually done it. And so I'm kind of a curiosity around here. But I never went back to it, and I didn't follow up on it. You know, never stayed with computing or anything like that. So then this brief flurry of activity.
So then in graduate school, when you were doing your modeling thesis, were you running modeling through a computer? Did you have some?
Yeah. By that time, Fortran was a pretty well-established language, nowhere near as powerful as what my students use today.
Yeah.
But Fortran was there. You didn't have to, you know, I was initially, when I went to the University of Michigan, I was writing my own programs to invert a matrix. I mean, now that would be unheard of. No one, I think most people don't even know how to do it other than pressing a button. But the, so it was even in the mid 60s, when I was now already at the University of Michigan, programming was still a new thing. Mm-hmm. And, but my, all my work was dealt with what we now do by computers. Then we had partly by computers, partly we were doing it by hand, even inverting matrices by hand sometimes. So it all seems very odd today.
So did Michigan have, I know the history of computing to a certain degree, Harvard, Princeton, I know some of the universities that had some of the major computers and were innovative in those developments. Did Michigan have?
Yes, they did have. They had their own programming languages. They were had actually very advanced computing.
Okay.
They had much better computing than Princeton had when I went there. Much more easily accessible. We still had cards and tape and all that stuff, which were everywhere those days. Mm-hmm. But they were, I said, had certainly better facilities than Princeton had at that time. I can't speak about Harvard, I don't know.
Okay.
But they had very good facilities. They had their own programming system. I forgot what they call it and had a name for it.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, of course, people stopped developing their own languages and, you know, this all became kind of a worldwide system. But the, my work was very heavily computer orientated. It had a lot of calculations to make.
And so any of the institutions that you were considering in Canada, did they have large computational systems there as well?
No.
No.
The Bank of Canada had, you know, when I was interviewing the Bank of Canada, the interviewer says, well, are you good at mathematics? So I very proudly tell him, you know, I took this and that courses of differential equations up here. He looked at me and he said, I mean, can you add? To give you an idea where the Bank of Canada was in those days, they had nothing. We had to use computers at the University of Montreal. We shipped programs back and forth at night by bus. The input goes in by bus, comes back the next morning by bus.
Wow.
They had computers at the University of Montreal. They had nothing. McGill had, as I've told you, some early stuff. It was okay, but it wasn't very much. And I don't know specifically about the University of Toronto at that time, because I never did consider seriously going there, because if I was going back to Canada, I would go to McGill.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, you know, I was just curious about, because I mean, you mentioned that Professor Smith talked you into to going to the University of Michigan.
Yeah.
I was just curious to know whether or not, you know, a university can have an interest in an area, but not necessarily the support for that interest.
Well, mainly I was concerned that I could teach in that area. That was one of the things I was concerned about. In those years, there was nothing like the support that anybody gets today at a distinguished university, whether it's Rice or Penn or any of these other places. The level of support at the University of Michigan at that time was minimal in terms of finances to going to have research assistants, stuff like that. But I was fortunate enough to be able to get support from the National Science Foundation for a long time. I mean, for longer than they should have. I mean, we were, by the time my kind of relationship in that along that lines with the National Science Foundation ended, it should have ended years before. I mean, we were no longer doing things as innovative as we were doing in the early years. So, but anyways, that's just a side side issue, but we were supported principally by the National Science Foundation over the years, sometimes the Ford Foundation. So I did a project that lasted 5 or 6 years, the Ford Foundation kind of doing joint work with the Central Statistical Office, both in Zagreb in Yugoslavia and Budapest in Hungary. And those were in the bad old days when, you know, it was still an Iron Curtain, not in Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia had its own dictatorship, but the Hungary was still part of the Eastern European bloc controlled by the Soviet Union at that time. And, you know, I've always, so I wondered when I got to the first time I went, you might be interested in this. The first time I went on this trip, the idea was I was going to work with the Central Statistical Office in these places to help them build their modeling efforts, how they would model. These countries all had five-year plans. The year three, they had no idea where they were. They didn't know if they were overachieving, underachieving, partially. They didn't know anything. So they thought that maybe you get some economic forecasting models of one kind that might help them with that. So I got approached by the Ford Foundation to see if I'd be interested in spending time in Yugoslavia and Hungary to help them get their modeling, computation, so on set up. So I said, okay, and I did, and I spent, you know, obviously this was part-time, but I spent quite a bit of time in Yugoslavia and in Zagreb, now not in Serbia. I visited Serbia, but I was mainly in Zagreb, Croatia, and in Budapest. When I first got there, I walked in the front door of the Central Statistical Office in Budapest looking for a particular person. He was standing there waiting for me because, of course, I didn't know a word of Hungarian. And he says, well, the director of the of this Central Statistical Office wants to speak to you before we get started. I figured he was there to welcome me or something. We go up this person's office. Turns out he is also a member of the Central Committee of the Soviet Party, of the Communist Party in Hungary. And he asks me, essentially, has the CIA sent you here? I mean, he didn't put it that way, but that's what he was asking me. And I said, no. And I told him, explained what the Ford Foundation is. And he said, well, you sure the CIA didn't send you? I said, I can only tell you what I know. And I was contacted by the Ford Foundation, and that's what I know. He said, fine, you can, you know, go work with our colleagues here. And I never heard another word about it the whole time I was there. But in later years, it turns out the CIA sometimes funneled money through these foundations. I have no idea if this was the case here. I hadn't the slightest idea. I have no knowledge of any kind, but I've always wondered about it since then, because of course we were accumulating data and about not only the Hungarian and Yugoslav economy, we were accumulating data on the Soviet economy because we were comparing their models with the models we were building, and the Czechoslovakian economy. And so we had a lot of data put together by the end of this. And so my colleague in Hungary, I had a colleague I worked with there, said, okay, I said to him, let's now put some articles together on all this hard work we've done, and we'll publish them in you know, some journal somewhere. So he says, well, he said, we can write these articles certainly, but before we publish them, we have to send them to the committee here for review, some kind of review. So I said, well, I'm not used to that. I'm used to, you know, deciding and then let the journals decide whether this is a worthy piece of research or not. Well, he says, well, I'm sorry, but, you know, that is the rules here. Well, I said, I know it's the rules there, but it's not the rules of the University of Michigan. He says, to you, he said, this is what he said to me. I'll never forget. He said, well, to you, he says, this is a matter of principle. For me, it's the job. So I said, okay. I finally understood. And we sent it to the whatever committee it was. I was not involved with that. And they said they weren't sure. They better send it to the Academy of Social Sciences in Moscow. Let them review this. And we do. And they say, well, you're too critical of the Soviet Union and its allies in this kind of work. You should, and they didn't use these words, but you should reconsider the way you describe this and so on. So he and I have a little tug of war, how much modification we can make. And so we finally, my colleague and I agree, okay, we've got this thing settled. We're not a little less critical than we were. And we were both satisfied. We send it back to the Soviet Academy of Sciences, who by this time I'm in back in Ann Arbor, and they send me a 6-page single space letter in Russian. Of course, I can't read one word of Russian, but we do have a Russian studies department, or did have at Princeton, I'm sure they still have. So I sent it to my colleagues there to read what's going to happen. Can we go ahead or we can't go ahead? So they write back that this is, we will ready to approve this paper. However, they say, you're not critical enough. They're the opposite. You know, we're not critical enough. And, you know, criticism of the way we progress, you know about historical materialism and so on. Criticism is central to getting the historical materialism to work itself out and so on and so forth. So I said, oh, good. I said to my colleague, we can put back the stuff we had. He said to me, you don't understand. This means we can go ahead. He says, we're not putting anything back in. And that's what we did.
Wow.
So eventually got published here in the U.S., but
it took some time to get through.
Their process took some time. Yeah. You know, it was a little exasperating at the time. I mean, now in retrospect, you know, why should have I cared that much about it? But at the time, I did. Yeah.
So can you tell me a little bit more what it was like starting up at the University of Michigan? You mentioned Professor Smith was like, come here, do your work. We'll figure out courses later.
I had to teach. I mean, everybody had a teaching requirement, mm-hmm. but I could teach in things that really concerned me and things that I was working on. So I taught a lot in the quantitative area. So we all had to teach. I mean, they didn't decrease my teaching load. And as you could have guessed, teaching loads in those years were a little heavier than they are today in most places like Michigan or Princeton and so on. So we had to teach 2 courses every semester, mm-hmm. and I had to do that, but I could do it in the area that I was working in. That was the big difference, and that they cared about my research. They really expressed some interest in it. And so as far as I'm concerned, the University of Michigan did exactly what they said they were going to do. Mm-hmm. And I really liked it there. I mean, we were very surprised at the end of the day to be ever moved from Ann Arbor. We loved the town. We liked the university, had good friends there and so on.
So when you were at the university, I know that you progressed up the ranks, right? You started as assistant professor, you became associate professor in 67.
I had 3 years to associate and 3 years to full professor, right?
Right.
Then the graduate program.
Right. So when you were teaching, were you teaching both undergraduates and graduate students?
Yes.
Okay. And did you have graduate students working with you on your research, or did they?
Mainly they were working with me on their theses for the most part. We had a group of research assistants in what we call the research seminar in quantitative economics, which by that time was run by one of my colleagues, Saul Hyman, and myself. Mm-hmm. And these are graduate students coming through. They were research assistants for us, and they generally picked thesis topics somehow related to the work that they were doing. They weren't always, usually not directly related, but related to doing quantitative work, using data, using computation, and so on. Or they may have been developing, for example, we were building these big models of the U.S. economy. They may have been working on the housing sector. So we do something special and detailed in the housing sector, which would help us out, but would go a lot farther than we needed for our purposes. But for the thesis purposes, it worked just well. So it's typically that kind of thing. Okay. Associated, but not directly needed in the work that we were doing.
Okay. In 1976, you had the title research scientist in the Institute of Labor and Industrial Relations and research scientist in the Institute of Public Policy Studies.
Yes, I had those titles, but didn't change anything but what I was doing. Okay. I was just working in an area helping people, particularly, I guess it was Malcolm Cohn, I think, who had a number of research grants from the state government in particular. And I was helping him deal with the state employment and things like that using some of the techniques that I was used to. So that was not a something that I generated myself. It was something where someone else had generated some grant funding money and I needed help in some areas. And that's what I was doing. So I joined that project.
Okay. And so that's why looking at your CV, you're listed as being a professor of economics and public policy.
Yes, that's right.
87, is that because of the grants that you were working on, or is there?
87?
It says 77 to 87.
Yeah, that's right. So grants that I was working on, that's right.
Okay.
And by that time, I developed interest in policies also, you know, in economic policy. I began testifying in Washington on economic issues and things of that nature.
So what brought up that interest in policy?
Well, the kind of models we were building are only of any use to people who are in policy. So we have these big econometric models of the U.S. economy. The main question you're trying to ask them is not simply what GNP is going to be next year. You want to be able to confront those models with different policy choices. So supposing government expenditures is at this level or at that level, supposing monetary policy is got this characteristic or that characteristic, what does it mean for the future of the economy? Mm-hmm. So you're asking these questions all the time. So it's a natural question for a policymaker to care about. That is, if government expenditures are going to be X or X plus Y, what difference would it make? And where would the difference show up? In what sectors of the economy would it show up? But, you know, we were forecasting GNP 2 or 3 years ahead by quarter, so with quarterly economic models, in the sense that we forecast, let's say, 12 quarters ahead. That was interesting and gave us some information, but mainly we tried to compare situations where the levers of policy were set at different spots. So you naturally became interested in policy. What should the Fed do? What should the Treasury do? What should HHS do? And what difference would it make? Mm-hmm. So that was our main interest. So that's how I got my interest in policy. Grew out of my interest. I mean, my thesis was, I actually did my thesis at Princeton concerned a model of the Canadian economy. Mm-hmm. Where I tried to model the behavior of the central bank. And I tried to understand the central bank, how the central bank behaved and what difference it made. That was the nature of the thesis I had at Princeton. So that was a very crude model compared to what we eventually developed at the University of Michigan.
So I want to talk about your transition into provost, but something just occurred to me that I hadn't thought to ask. So two of your daughters were born in the United States, correct?
Correct.
So they were American citizens.
Yes.
The other four of you, your wife and your other two daughters, did you become citizens?
Yes, we did. In late, I don't remember the year, let's say 78, something very close to that.
Okay.
In the late 70s sometime. Yeah.
So is that the point where you just accepted that you were going to be, even though you'd been here?
I guess we felt that, at that time, we certainly didn't have any, we couldn't see in our future that we would return to Canada. And, it took us a few years to decide, but the key issue, the key development was Canada passed a law roughly 76, 77, in there somewhere, that said if you took an oath of allegiance to another country as part of a naturalization proceeding, then it didn't count. That is, you could still keep your Canadian citizenship. Mm-hmm. So then the emotional issue was gone, right? We didn't, we could be, so now we're dual citizens. We got both Canadian and U.S. passports. Yeah. Now, I haven't used my Canadian passport in 20 years, at least, maybe 30 years. But yes, we have dual citizenship. All four of those of us who were born in Canada, have dual citizenship. Right?
Okay. So what brought about the provost position at the university?
Okay, I had, as you know, since you've obviously looked at my vita, I had been a chair of the economics department the three previous years. And that was nothing special. I was a little young to be chairman of the department, but we had it rotated every 3 years. So it's just something you were expected to do during your time at Michigan. You served once as chairman. So it wasn't a career decision or anything like that. It was something that was very nice. I was young, but I'd get it done with. And I did serve 3 years. And at the end of those 3 years, my wife and I decided to take a 2-week vacation with our family up in northern Michigan. And there's a lot of lakes up there and so on. So we rented a cottage at a lake in northern Michigan. About a week into this vacation, I get a call from the president of the university who says, well, the provost of the university at that time, Frank Rhodes was is now going to become president of Cornell. And would you consider becoming provost? This is over the phone. I'm sitting in a cabin in northern Michigan. So I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what a provost did. I never knew a provost. I hardly knew the dean. I mean, so I didn't know what to say, but it was the president of the university. So I said, well, I'm due to come home back down to Ann Arbor, maybe 200 miles away. I said, in another week, what if I see you come by your office a week from now? I figure by that time, I'd at least know a little bit what a provost was. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, he said, I think a week is a little too long. I think I'd like to see you earlier. So to make a long story short, I just get in the car and drive back. Mm-hmm. Leave my family at this, and I drive back, and I needed directions to his office. I didn't know where the president of the university hung out, where his office was. I had to get directions to his office. I go in there. He's a very nice person. I mean, I got to like him quite a bit, and we sit down, and he tells me Frank Rhodes, who I knew. I knew Frank Rhodes not because he was provost, because his children the same age as mine, and we ended up in the same PTA meetings at school a number of times over the years. That's how I knew him. I knew he was a geologist. I barely knew he was provost. So the president describes to me what the provost position is, and I sort of get the general idea of what it is and how it relates to the deans and so on and so forth. And I said, okay. And he says to me right there, he says to me, and I'd like you to do this. I said, well, I need some time to think about it. I need to speak to my family and so on. So he said, no, of course, such informality is, out of the question these days, probably all for the good. So I said, well, you have to wait. I can't give you an answer now. I got to go, but I'm going to speak to my family. I'll be back in town in a week or whatever it was, 5 days at that time. And I'll let you know. I'll drive back up and I begin discussions with my wife, and my wife said, well, as long as you don't have to leave town, I'm not against it. I said that I'm not leaving Ann Arbor until all our children are through high school, period. And so she said, if you don't have to leave town, you think you might like it, try it. So I spent the next few days calling people I knew at the university and asking them what they thought about this, thought if I might be any good at this and so on. And they were very supportive. So when I got back to town, I went to see him again and said, okay, I'm willing to consider it. What are the general conditions of this? And I started off in that I couldn't possibly have known what I was doing. It's just not possible. I mean, I'd been chairman of my department, but that was just a rotating thing. I'd never been a dean. I'd never built a big program up. I mean, in 3 years, you don't build a big program. And what on earth possessed me to say yes, and why I thought I might, I mean, how could I even imagine I might do this in a place the size of the University of Michigan? We had that time 25,000 employees, and you were in charge of the budget of the whole university and a medical center. You had the whole, big state university situation. Anyways, I took a chance, accepted the job, and started. and did the best I could. I mean, that's how I got started in university administration. I mean, it's.
Did you find out at any point why your name was on the list for provost?
I didn't find out exactly, but I did inquire a little bit about that. Mm-hmm. That is, I had chaired, there was a faculty committee and existed for many years, which on budget priorities. And I, for I think 1 or 2 years, chaired that committee. So I knew a little bit about the budget and then roughly what some of the things, you know, that were on the margin being struggled with and so on. But that was about it. I mean, I had no intention and, you know, nobody on that faculty committee had thought that they were going anywhere. They just were on this faculty committee. And so that's the only thing I can, I've been chairman of the department, but that was, yeah, you know, it did some work, but it's, so, but I guess you got to get started somewhere. That's how I got started.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not trying to trivialize things in any way, but I'm curious to know whether or not your experience in those several years after college running the family business, did anything there apply to what it was like to become provost?
Well, I think it applied a little bit. I don't, one, it's very hard to know. Two, I think it helped a little bit. I'd worked with groups of people. I knew what payroll was. I knew how a financial organization had to get focused, even though it was a shadow of the, it's nothing like the University of Michigan. I mean, we had, I think, at the, in the restaurant, something like 220 employees. The University of Michigan had 25,000. I mean, it's just a totally different world. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I'm sure that I've never thought about it carefully. That's the first thing I would say.
Okay.
But I'm sure there's some things I must have picked up that were useful, at least in some circumstances.
Okay. And so your position as provost, you have it listed as 77 through 79. Were those academic years or calendar years?
Let's see. I think it's a, I think it's July 77, I think, is when I started. And I think January 1, 80, I was president, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's about 2.5, 3 years. I'm not sure exactly. You know, the president had told me when he asked me to become provost that he was thinking of leaving. He was very honest with me. He was thinking of leaving in the next few years. At the time, it never bothered me. I never thought I would be president, so I thought it was just something. You know, one thing I always remind myself about is when I came to the University of Michigan as a young faculty member, not only I didn't know who the president was, I didn't care who the president was. You know, I always reminded myself about that because, you know, the president is way up there somewhere, down there somewhere. You don't, you, to most faculty members, it's a distant kind of relationship, especially at a big university. But I always reminded myself about that because there was no reason to believe things had changed anyway when I became president. So it always helped me induce a little modesty about what I could accomplish. And, well, you know, the real work still goes on in the laboratories and in the classroom. That's where the real work goes on. And these administrative jobs are important. I think leadership matters. But you have to have a sense, a modest sense of what you're doing. You know, the first interview I gave after I became president of the university to the, was to the student newspaper. And this young man and a young man, a young woman came, and this young man says to me, well, aren't you afraid that during your time as president here, you'll wreck the university, or a question like that. I mean, he may not have used those words, but I remember what I said. I said, look, this is like a big ocean liner. I can do a little to move it in one direction or another, but I can't turn it around. It's got its own momentum, which is taking place where all the students and the faculty are. And that's what's going to carry it forward for the most part. I'll change a little direction here and there and hope that'll be helpful, but I can't wreck it. It's just impossible. I can't wreck it. And, you know, I always, while it's a trivial little circumstance, I always, it's helpful to remember that the work of the university is going on. Yes, if you were president for 80 years, you could possibly wreck a place if no one was watching. But, you know, that's just a thought experiment as opposed to reality.
You'd mentioned that when your first economics course at McGill, the president of McGill, I think, was teaching.
Yes, that's right.
Course. When you moved into the provost position and then later the presidency, were you able to stay connected to students in a similar way
in
where
classes? In almost every semester, maybe every semester, I'd have to go back and check before I made that claim. Mm-hmm. Most semesters, most years, I taught at least one course.
Okay.
And I think I never taught any more than one. Mm-hmm. Now, it may be in there I missed a year somehow for reasons that I don't remember right now. So I'd have to go back and check the record before making a blanket claim. But I'd always been teaching some in a modest way. I mean, one course is very modest. But I wanted to keep it. And I told my wife at the time that I'm going to go back to teaching before I retire. Mm-hmm. That's where I started. That's where I want my career to end. And when I got to be 65, my wife looked at me one day and said, well, if you want to go back to teaching, you better do it because time moves on. And that's why I retired from Princeton when I did. Mm-hmm. I did want to go back teaching before, you know, who knows what. I didn't expect my health to hold up quite so long. And it seemed two things coincided. One, my claim that I wanted to go back to teaching, and my wife's constant reminder that it's good to quit when you're ahead. Mm-hmm. And things were going well at Princeton at that time, so it was a good time for the university to make a change. Hmm.
So how did the transition to the presidency at Michigan happen? Was it the president retired and...
The president retired. I don't know the details. I can only know what I encountered, right? Mm-hmm. What I encountered was I had one meeting which seemed to have some regents of the university, some faculty, and a student on the committee, or two students, I can't remember. I had one meeting with them, and presumably they had meetings with others. I'm sure in the archives of the university, that's all noted down somehow. And the next thing I knew is I heard from the chairman of the Board of Regents at that time, that they would like me to consider being president. That was, so I had one interview and that was it. And I, next thing I hear from the chairman of the board, I don't even know who the other people they considered were. I'm sure they did consider others. I can't say more because I don't know more. Mm-hmm. Then they somehow decided that maybe I could do this. Those were very difficult years at Michigan because the impact of the two oil boycotts in the early 70s and the late 70s, early 80s, really had a big impact on this, on the state of Michigan because of its impact on the automobile industry. And so there were very serious financial issues that all universities in Michigan, I mean, all state-supported universities in Michigan faced at that time. Mm-hmm. I don't know why that would have played a role or may have played a role. I just don't know.
In the position, both positions, both as provost and president, were you still able to do the policy work that you had been starting?
Yes, I was. I think I don't remember all the exact dates, but yes, I was able to do policy work because I was able to spend time in Washington. I didn't live in Washington any time. But, you know, it was an hour plane ride from Detroit to Washington. So it was very easy to go there sometime the same day, come back the same night. Those were before the TSA was around. And so you can just rush into the plane at the last minute and you'd be just fine. Couldn't do that now so easily. And yes, I was able. And in fact, the Regents of the University encouraged me to spend some time both in Lansing on state policy and in Washington on federal policy, because they understood very well that parts of our university, parts of most research universities, were dependent on policies being followed in the science and technology area in Washington. Whether NIH budget was in good shape or bad shape made a big difference. Mm-hmm. to anyone with a medical center. And but of course, that was not only that, it was the NSF and all the others at various parts of the university were close to dependent upon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So yeah, they thought that that was an appropriate role for the president of Michigan. So they were very supportive in that way.
I know that we've been going for a little over an hour and a half. Do you need to take a break to get some water or anything like that?
No, I have a Coke here, but I'm not thirsty right now.
Okay. I just wanted to.
What about yourselves? You might want to take a break.
I'm fine, Kenny.
You're muted,
Kenny.
I'm going to just turn my video off for like 30 seconds, but please feel free to continue.
Okay.
So, my next set of questions is going to be about your move over to Princeton. But before I do that, I wanted to just sort of turn things over to you. Is there anything that, we told you a little bit about the project, the Presidential Council of Advisors on Science and Technology. Is there anything during your time at Michigan that you think would be relevant for us to know, given the nature of the overall project? Connections to you'd mentioned having the grant at the NSF for quite some time. Did you have other people that you...
Well, I can't, to be honest with you, I don't know I can recall them all, because maybe I should have prepared better for this this meeting. But I'll give you an example. Representative Ford, at that time a member of Congress, was very important in the student financial aid programs of the federal government. He essentially shepherded them through the House for quite a few years. He was probably more important than anyone in Washington for the federal finance, not for their initiation necessarily, but for their maintenance and what initiatives they were going to take and so on. I spent quite a bit, he was a representative from Michigan. Not from the district, not around Ann Arbor. He was in the district near Detroit somewhere. Mm. I don't remember exactly where his district was. And so that's one of the things that first got me interested. He had me often, I had many discussions with him on student financial aid and what the federal programs might be or ought to be and so on. And so that's one thing that got me very interested. But there was another thing that got me very interested in policy, and it just was going on in Washington. When I left the department, I began to be provost and then president of the university. I was looking around for a subject that I might continue to involve myself with in economics that wasn't moving ahead so fast that I could actually keep up and play a role. Mm. In the area of econometrics, which is where I was working initially, that field was evolving so quickly that I just couldn't keep up with the work was going on. So it was no use me trying to teach graduate courses in econometrics anymore because I just wasn't up to date enough. The subject I landed on in my own head was technology transfer.
Mm.
That I got interested in technology transfer, namely, as you know, take a farm example, someone in one farm discovers a better way to grow corn, how quickly does that expand from that farmer to others in their county or others around the country, and what are the mechanisms and so on. Of course, I wasn't primarily interested in agriculture, I was primarily interested in science and technology. But I began writing in that area, began writing a series, I wrote some articles on this. For example, looking at the fact that there was a chasm between scientific discovery and economic impact. There's a whole series of institutions that intervene here, and one had to account for them more carefully than most economists and most universities have. You know, most universities say, look, if we're here, we're going to make all these great discoveries. There's going to be all this great economic development that occurs. And it all these claims by university presidents, I noticed, I felt at the time, this is my opinion, were out of touch. I just felt that they were unsophisticated. Yes, scientific discovery is extremely important, but it takes a lot more to turn that into something that individuals can benefit from or that would impact the economy. And so it was very common in those days for university presidents to say to their state representatives, look, if you spend money here, it'll be returned to you tenfold because of all the wonderful things that occur after you spend this money on basic research, all this. Well, I thought that was a very naive way to look at it. I thought that there was, you had to have a much more sophisticated way to think about how discovery, scientific discovery in the lab, gets transferred into some useful economic activity. So I began working on that area, trying to make the point to, for example, to my colleagues as presidents, that what they were saying to their state legislatures was just wrong on the face of it. And the legislators may not have known just what was wrong, but they knew what was wrong somehow. And I pointed out that, you know, if you spend money on anything, there's an immediate benefit. You can spend it on bridges, you can spend it in the laboratory, you can spend it on roads. It has an economic impact right away. But so what? Is scientific discovery really better than let's say spending it on roads or spending it on schools or spending it on bridges or whatever else you might think about? And I think that that question, very few college presidents can answer that question. Very, very few. Very few even have the patience to answer that question. And I got very interested in that because I thought if we didn't level with policymakers regarding the fact that, you know, the scientific enterprise was one of the things that could really benefit the economy in the long term. No question it could benefit, but it wasn't the only thing. And that you had to make a better case than just saying spending money helps. Yes, spending money helps. You can spend it on anything and that helps. Mm-hmm. Now, very often they would say, well, studies show that the rate of return on scientific discoveries is very high. You know, the numbers like 20%, 30%, 40%. And it was my view that anyone says the rate of return is that high just doesn't know what they're talking about. They've never really thought about it seriously. I don't know if you know or not, but, you know, the way I don't want to repeat things you already know very well, the way they really generate how much the return is on research, they try to measure what the contribution is of labor, of capital, and so on. Then everything left over, they say that's scientific research. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not all scientific. Some of it is scientific research, but it's not all scientific research. And figuring out what really does belong to science is very difficult. But you have to be much more modest or it's just unbelievable. I don't think there's a legislator in the world that believes that 40% is the rate of return on scientific research or numbers like that. But a lot of presidents and scientists have been to Congress and said things like that out loud. And so I got interested in seeing, could we be more modest and could we be, more a little bit more accurate in saying in indicating to representatives what we know and what we don't know. And there's nothing wrong with saying we don't know things, but that's very uncommon in that world because people are trying very hard to push very legitimate projects. And it's not that they're fooling people, they're not engaged in some criminal activity or anything like that, but they just are stretching knowledge beyond which they really, in my mind, no real evidence for it. So I think there is great evidence for the importance of scientific research, but it's not at the level that people, and that's what I thought in those days, not on the level of what people were complaining. And I thought, well, maybe I could play a role in getting us down to a more realistic playing field here. It was very, very difficult, especially amongst college presidents, because they wanted something simple, and something that they could claim, not without any evidence, but very little, at least it sounded plausible that they had a claim here. And I think myself, the Congress, in whatever way it had, knew better, that it couldn't possibly be that rate of return. Otherwise, we'd all be a lot richer than we are. So that's how I got interested in this and began looking at various aspects of it. That's how I got interested in policy that surrounds expenditures in science and technology. That's how I got interested in how the NIH works and what's good and bad about that, et cetera, et cetera. So I've worked in all those areas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the only thing that comes to my mind when talking about innovation, technology, science and technology policy is, you know, some of the work that I did in graduate school, yeah, where I think we were still using, I'm blanking on, Everett Rogers' work, mm-hmm, on the diffusion of innovation.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm remembering that correctly, yeah, but there are certain things that you need in order for innovation to spread in communities and the development of that. So yeah, my understanding of those of policy is quite limited just to that knowledge there. Yeah.
Well, that's right. It is hard, and if you want to put it, I don't know his work. But if it's geographically oriented, it's even harder. That is, if he's trying to measure how innovation spreads across geographies. Mm-hmm. That's a very, very hard question. And I don't think it's solved yet. I mean, we're still focusing on. So long story short, I was always interested in, you know, let's say what we can say as well as we can, but let's not exaggerate. Because I think nobody believes you when you exaggerate.
Yeah. So anything else from your time while in the provost or president position at Michigan?
No, the usual. I'm not going to bother with all the usual stuff. But
sure.
That impacts the university president.
So clearly all of your children finished high school,
yes,
right? Because in 1988, you did go back to Princeton.
And they were all out of the house by that time.
So can you tell me a little bit about how that came to be, going back to Princeton as president?
Well, yes, I can tell you how it came to be, to my knowledge. Of course, not knowledge of the whole, all sides of this. I had arranged with the University of Michigan for a 2-month sabbatical.
Mm.
I think it was January and February, when I get this right. Must be January and February of 87. And so my wife and I decided we'd spend 1 month in London and 1 month in New York, because the Ford Foundation had asked me to review their program in higher education. And so they arranged for me to spend 1 month in New York, to spend 1 month in London. We spend our 1 month in London, get back to New York. The Ford Foundation arranged for us to have an apartment in New York. And I get a call from Bill Bowen. He was that time president of Princeton, and telling me that he was going to retire. One, I was very surprised to get the call. I knew Bill Bowen, didn't know him all that well, but I knew him. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, you know, wish him luck. He told me he's going to work in the Mellon Foundation and so on. So, okay. I was a little wondered at that time why I got this call. I mean, it's the first time he ever called me about anything. And so I said, okay, wished him luck and so on. Well, within days of that call, I get a call from the chairman of the board at Princeton saying they are looking for a president. Of course, they all tell you the same thing. They don't want to tell you they're considering you, but they want to get your advice on what Princeton needs. This is a standard opening play in these kind of searches. And I'm around long enough to know that that's what that was. Well, okay, if I could help them with some views of Princeton, I certainly wanted to have breakfast with the chairman of the board of trustees. So he came to New York and I met him and we had breakfast and we talked and I told him what I thought about what little I knew. I didn't know a lot about Princeton, what I knew and what I thought and what kind of reputation it had and so on. And what I thought about the future, some general conversations of that type, which at that time I thought might be helpful to someone who's they're looking for a president. And Princeton had a long tradition of appointing presidents from within the university, which I assumed that they were going to do. And so I left that meeting feeling that was that. I mean, that was the end of this conversation. I had my say and so on. But now I have the Times not quite straightened out my mind, maybe a week or 10 days later, something like that. He calls me back and he said, well, he had a very interesting conversation. He said, I'd like to speak to you again. And so we go through this whole thing all over again, meet him exactly the same place in New York City. And we have a talk. And finally, he says, well, he said, in fact, we're interested in whether you might take a position. If you didn't offer me the position, then he said, if you might be interested. And I said, that was a big decision. I really didn't know, you know, and I'd have to sort of talk to my family and so on. But if he's in a rush, I can't be in a rush to make a decision like this. He said, no, we're not in a rush. And by this time, we're ready to go back to Ann Arbor. And we do go back to Ann Arbor. And then I get a call. I can't remember all the dates now, but let's say a few weeks later. This is all over by the middle of April, so it wasn't that long. Mm-hmm. And he says, well, we really are very serious about you. Could we come out, we meaning himself, some other member of the board of Princeton's board and a faculty member from Princeton, could we come out and see you in Ann Arbor? And I said, yes. They came out, and that's when my wife and I began discussing this seriously as a possibility. And we said, well, all right, we'll ask to visit Princeton. We'd like to see the campus, get a feel for it. So we did. We visited Princeton, came back home, and wait to see what happened. Well, within a relatively short period of time, again, I don't remember the exact details here, they called and the chairman, the vice chair, came out to Ann Arbor again and said, we would like to offer you this position. So then we really had to make a serious decision. And I'll be honest with you, my wife was very hesitant to go back to Princeton. She had this vision of Princeton as a very conservative place, et cetera, et cetera. And she had the vision of Princeton circa 1961. And despite the fact that, you know, they had tried to impress on us, things had changed, was now co-ed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I can't go through all these discussions that we had. It wouldn't be very informative for anybody. But frankly, I was kind of anxious to go, but really for my wife, I think it was just a big favor she did for me. Mm-hmm. And she just agreed to say, okay, something you want to do, I'm willing to try. I think if it was up to her, she would not have come at that time. To me, looking at just where the university was at that time, Princeton, and where Michigan was, I thought I could make a difference at a place which had a greater concentration on undergraduate education, which just by force of numbers has, doesn't take a big part of the president's time. At Princeton, you're too far away from it. You know, I was in a six-story building in Michigan with the president, the provost, and a bunch of other vice presidents and so on. And, you know, then below them, there was a whole bunch of other deans. Then the chairs, you were far away from what was really going on the ground unless you made a real effort. And even then, there were limits to what you could do. And I thought, here is a place where I could have a more direct impact, a more direct relationship, put it that way, with what was going on the ground in the laboratories and in the classroom. And I liked their focus on undergraduate education. And so it seemed to me like a good fit to try, and really my wife's goodwill, more than anything else, settled the issue. I mean, because otherwise it certainly wouldn't have gone if she hadn't agreed. But I think to this day that I think, you know, without her, we wouldn't be here. It turned out we liked it very much here. I mean, it turned out that things had changed a lot, and that it wasn't just propaganda and that things had changed. It was really things had changed the university an awful lot. We found the trustees to be very liberal-minded and very easy to focus on you know, difficult social issues that come up during, you know, the last 30, 40 years, universities, whether it's the co-ed education was behind Princeton by that time.
Right.
So I wasn't involved in any way in that, but all the other issues that come up. And so we came here, and much to her surprise, we really enjoyed it here. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, when I retired, I would have either gone back to Ann Arbor or gone back to Montreal when I retired as president. Mm-hmm. But we didn't do either, and so we're still here.
Okay. Now, I know it was 1990 that you first started with PCAST. Is that correct?
I don't know. It was around then. I don't remember that. You probably have a better idea than I do.
Okay. Well, so let me start with this. How did you who inquired with you about participating in PCAST?
You know, I think it was Alan Bromley.
Okay.
Now, I don't have perfect recollection of that, but I think it must have been him. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was him. He at least convinced me to join it. If he didn't, wasn't the one initially asked, I don't remember. But I think he had called me. I think that's my recollection.
And did you have an awareness of PCAST prior to that phone call? No. So this was... So in asking you to participate, if it was Bromley, if it was someone else, what do you remember what you were being asked to do?
Well, the idea was, yes, I mean, I don't remember the details. We didn't have initially a full agenda worked out, but the idea was that we would have access to the president mm-hmm. and his capacity and or potential willingness to make investments in areas in the science and technology area, which we thought were appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And that raises, I mean, when I thought about this meeting, that raises an issue, which I want to make sure I mention. So I think it's appropriate right here, but if it's not, I apologize.
Yeah.
I've been in all these advisory groups. I haven't been in all of them. I've been in most of them one way or another during this time period. And what's critical, let's take PCAST as an example. And so Alan Bromley was the chief. He was there full time in the White House, right? He was whatever his exact title was. Mm-hmm. He was full time in the executive office building, had a suite of offices there. What was critical to PCAST was access to the president. That is, not that I could call a president, but that Alan Bromley could call a president and get to see him within days or some reasonable period of time. That is, in my view, and reflecting on all these things, absolutely key if you're at the level of a presidential advisory thing. Some presidential advisory committees can never get to see the president. The president's just not interested. He hasn't got time. He'd say he or she, whatever, is interested. But in fact, when you ask whoever is Bromley or Bromley's replacement in a similar type committee, do you see the president? Can you see the president? If the answer isn't yes, you are not going to have a very effective time in terms of policy impact. You may have a good time relating with your colleagues, all of whom are very interesting and lively people, and you may even publish something that has some impact in the field somewhere, which is a very positive thing to do. But if you're asking, are you going to have an impact on public policy during the term of this president, whoever it happens to be, whether it's Bush or Clinton or anyone, that's the question. Will his chief science person, whoever that turns out to be, really be able to see him? And will he really be able to see the head of OMB almost whenever he wants? I don't mean tomorrow at 7 o'clock, but you know, this week I need to see you about something.
Yeah.
That is what's key, in my opinion, in my observations I have made. Because when you can see the president on a, you know, periodic basis, everything changes. People know you've been there to see the president. People know what you've said. It's never any secret. And this filters down into the system. And so my experience is that this is a critical aspect. If you're working at the level of a presidential advisory commission, can you see the president in some form, in some way? So when I served, to take probably a less important, when I served as chairman of the National Bioethics Advisory Commission during the Clinton administration, the key was, could I get to the president? Mm-hmm. That was the key. Then I knew what we were doing. I knew what we could do. I knew where we could be useful. And he would be not, didn't do everything we wanted or anything like that, but we got responses. Something was happening. So to take another example, working on the same committee, the National Bioethics Advisory Commission, the issue there, let's say you're dealing with an issue like human subject research, just to take an old and still lively example. The key there would not be so much to see the president, but you've got to get to HHS. You've got to get to the secretary. So that NIH knows when you write a letter, they have to answer it. It doesn't just disappear into their voluminous files. Right. That they know that they have to answer it. Because otherwise you'll go directly to the secretary. So those kind of connections make a huge difference on how much impact these voluntary advisory committees do, which typically have very smart people on them, my experience. I mean, I've never met anyone on these committees that I thought shouldn't be there, didn't know what they were doing or something. It's beyond at least my experience. But it wasn't always the president, but it was something to make sure your mail was answered, to put it in a colloquial way. Mm-hmm. Because most of the time, and all these advisory committees and all the things they say and do, the mail is not answered. And sometimes they have effects other ways, other times don't. But to me, the key issue is, I mean, I know this is a very colloquial way to say this, it sounds even silly, but that's really what counts if you're thinking about having an impact, you know, now, next year or two, next two or three, and so on. So I've had experience both ways, where our mail was never answered or answered in a way that didn't matter, or where they knew that, you know, it had to be answered. Otherwise, they'd be answering to someone else. They much prefer to answer to us and have to, and let's take the HHS, and have to answer to the Secretary of HHS, who's going to be in charge of their budget in, you know, next week or sometime soon. Mm-hmm. So that's really, this is just my experience, that this is very critical. And doesn't always have to be the president, but you just have to think, if you're asked to serve in a committee, where does this committee really get its, what do they really care about? What does, you know, and so I remember this most clearly, for example, I once served as they were looking at the internal structure, the structure of NIH, and what role the director of NIH has versus what role the heads of the institutes have and so on. And this was just before, you may remember, you may not remember, at one time there was a five-year period in which NIH budgets doubled. Mm-hmm. This is a time when Billy Frist was chairman of the, I guess he was leader of the Senate or something like that. So he was very influential in that. So I was asked to do with a committee, a study of NIH, its structure, its administrative structure. You know, what role does the director have? How does that relate to the director of the various institutes and so on? And if this was going to NIH itself, you might as well save yourself the time and effort. If you were talking not to the heads of NIH, but you're talking to the secretary, head of HHS, there's a whole different world as to what can happen and what will happen. That's at least my experience.
So I'm going to turn things over to Kenny. He's a subject area expert on PCAST. So he'll be leading the questions, but I may still chime in.
All right. I remember PCAST well, yeah.
Well, great. Thank you, Dave. So your discussion on needing you know, the attention of the president kind of begs the question for Bromley and G.H.W. Bush's PCAST. Did you feel like you got the time you needed with the president or other?
I think that my experience was that Bromley, one way or another, had pretty free access to the president at that time. I don't know in what way it was true, but he was always able to either deliver something or tell you we weren't going to get it delivered. It's not that we could do anything we wanted or anything like that, but he had access to the president. And, you know, people do things for symbolic reasons. So I'm going to give you two examples, which have nothing to do with the structure of NIH or the structure of PCAST or anything. Well, I was a member of PCAST. We had one meeting at Camp David, okay, where the president was up there that weekend, and we were all up there that weekend, and we had our meeting, Did a lot of work get done? No, a lot of work didn't get done. There's too many distractions at Camp David to think that any work is going to get done. But that meant everything to members of the committee. They really felt that that the president was there. He took whatever it was, a morning and an afternoon, I don't remember. He took that time. It was his personal time. And he was there, and he was listening to what we had to say. I think this is more ceremonial than anything else. I mean, I think he could have in some way done without that. But it meant an enormous amount to the committee members. To get to an even more trivial observation, it's very important to committee members, whether they meet in a hotel room somewhere or they meet in the executive office building or some similar place like that, depending on which, you know, what they're doing. It doesn't have to be the executive office building. It could be another government building. To meet in the basement of a hotel somewhere is like something you do every day. And it's true, this is all symbolism, right? It's got no real impact on the substance of anything you're discussing or anything else like that. But it has an impact in the way it makes people feel about what they're doing. Now, I haven't done a study of this, but it wouldn't be at all surprising to me if you had an attendance record of committees that meet, let's say, in the executive office building or with the head of HHS or something like that, versus NIH at NIH headquarters versus meeting in the, you know, in the basement of the Regency something hotel, Hyatt Regency something hotel, you would find that attendance is very different. Now, I haven't done the study. I don't know if that's true. But it's this kind of symbolism means a lot to people who are very busy and could easily be doing something else. You know, the kinds of people that they generally attract these committee are very talented, very busy people. They have busy research going on. If they meet at the National Academy, that's very symbolic. If they meet, depending what their role is, there's lots of government facilities that they could meet. It doesn't have to be the White House or the executive office building, but something that's relevant to what they're doing. So at the committee I had dealing with the structure of NIH, we met at NIH each time. That felt like something good to people. They knew they were there. This is the place where things happen. If you need to speak to someone, there's someone there, etc. So these symbolic things, I think, add up to the effectiveness of the committee and the enthusiasm with which they do their work. That's just my observation.
Yeah, I mean, the Camp David meeting is very historic as far as...
Yeah. Right. PCAST. I think it's unique as far as I know, at least for this kind of committee. I don't know. I haven't checked it. And, you know, it doesn't have to be Camp David. I mean, Camp David is a whole, as you know, it's a whole other production to go to Camp David. So I don't say that you have to do that. But, you know, so.
Did you then meet, in terms of this symbolism, did PCAST then meet in the...
We met at the executive office building, typically. That's where we met. We may have sometimes I met elsewhere, I can't remember, but we typically met in the executive office building. Sometimes we met, I'm not sure which committee I'm relating to now in my mind, but we've even met occasionally in the Roosevelt Room in the White House, but that was rather unusual. I mean, that did happen, but it didn't. And then, you know, in those days, or at least the days I'm thinking about right now, security was at a totally different level. I mean, now it's like, and even more so in recent years, it's, you're going into an army base or something. So now this all may be, for logistical reasons, harder. I don't know about that. That could easily be.
Yeah. Were there, so coming into PCAST, were there issues, if you did have the attention of the president, that you thought PCAST should be working on, or things you brought to PCAST?
You know, the first thing that comes to mind is a negative rather than a positive thing. That is, I don't remember the exact words that were used, but we were definitely told, either at our first or second meeting, that we couldn't work on anything to deal with population. They didn't want to hear about the population problem, if there was one. That's not something that they wanted to. So I just accepted that. I remember I was a member of the committee at that time. I wasn't vice chair yet. And I just took that as, you know, I wasn't going to work on that anyway. But I took it as a symbol about the abortion issue, that they didn't want anything that even approached dealing with issues of reproduction. So they didn't say that. I mean, Bromley didn't say that. He was the one that brought the message. Bromley didn't say that, so maybe I'm wrong about that. But that's how I interpret it. We never did do anything, but I don't think there was anyone on the committee at that point in time that had a particular interest in anything related to reproduction. But that clearly was a message that we received early on. But that was on the negative side, things we couldn't do. I think my recollection was that we had a pretty open agenda when we began. That Bromley undoubtedly had ideas, and I'm sure his ideas were, I don't remember the details, were very important to us. I mean, I looked at him anyway as the messenger of the president, and if he had an idea that we ought to work in this and that area, that was a pretty good signal that we should try to be responsive to that. But, you know, some of these, you know, one of the problems with the way the U.S. Civil service works is all the key positions get changed every time there's a new president, right? So you go over and over things, right? There's nobody there that said, you know, we did that last year with a Democratic president or the problem, whatever the case may be. There is no really good memory at a very high level, in my opinion, in the what I would call a civil service, is public service, whatever we call it, because so many of the appointments, as you know, are political appointments. Some of them are very good appointments. Just some political appointments are very good appointments. So Bromley undoubtedly was a political appointment of some kind. I don't know the details, but. It was, at least in my experience, a good appointment. So, you know, so these things really matter. But you asked a more positive question. What was the question you asked? I didn't respond to your question.
Question is, if there were particular issues that you felt needed presidential attention.
What years was that I was in PCAST? Do you remember?
1990 was the year it started.
What year?
1990.
Yeah. I'm just trying to think back now. Well, you know, I don't recall right now anything beyond the standard kind of issues that people interested in science and technology work on. That is, you know, at what level, what's the optimal level of science and technology research in a country, and how do we achieve that, putting together both the private and the public sector? I don't have any detailed recollection of that agenda. whatever we wrote, you know what we wrote. I mean, someone knows. There's publications there. I haven't looked back on those for quite some time. I should in preparation of this meeting.
No, it's all good. I'm really curious about what you remember, because these reports are historical interest to me and to Dave. So I'm just curious what your thoughts were going home.
My only recollection is I thought, you know, I enjoyed my time there, which means not simply that I liked the people who were there, which I did, but that I thought that the reports we made were decent. They spoke to the issues that we were concerned with at the time. I mean, the issues really haven't changed much in all these years, right? The issues you keep coming back to, you know, what is the optimal level of our federally sponsored R&D in this country? How much in R and how much in D? These are the standard everyday issues which are yet to be resolved. Yeah. And so you keep coming back to them and keep trying to make arguments. Usually, if you're in a committee like this, you know, usually in favor of more. I don't know of any committee that offered less to my knowledge. And that comes to a point I wanted to make. Two things. In these advisory committees, it's very hard to prevent them from wanting to make policy. Right? They are trying to think of what the policy should be. Now, if you're a scientific advisory committee, you have one thing in mind, the health of the science and technology enterprise.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe the health of the economy associated with that. However, the average congressman doesn't have an agenda like that. I know of no congressman that has that as an agenda. What they have is a lot of different agendas, dealing with everything from roads to healthcare to social security to defense. I mean, science and technology, yes, they believe that's important, but they have all these other concerns, which are very legitimate concerns for a congressperson to have. And in these committees, you often get to a point where people are trying to take the role of a congressman, or trying to anticipate the role of a congressman, or trying to write a report that is likely to appeal to different groups in Congress, as opposed to just what you think about this problem. And this, it confuses the role of the advisors in science and technology and the congressional responsibilities that congressmen have. And there's just tremendous emphasis. So to give you an example, which is probably, I don't know if it's a good example, I'll tell you what the example is anyways. So I'm head of the National Bioethics Advisory Commission, and we're dealing with cloning. It's very odd now. Dolly the sheep seems like a mystical fairy tale right now, but, you know, for a brief few months, it was in the paper every day. We were trying to decide, what are we going to recommend to the president regarding cloning? We were given 60 days to report to the White House on how we're supposed to, what do we recommend the president do in respect to this new scientific discovery? You cannot prevent the committee from discussing this in relationship to abortion, to how the committee, how the science, how the Congress is going to respond to an issue related to abortion. And maybe we should phrase it this way because that'll appeal to this one and that. I mean, it was very hard to disentangle the real role of the committee. What was it there to do? We weren't there, in my opinion, to discuss the things which were Congress's responsibility, how they're going to feel about the pro-life, pro-choice issue. That was not what we were assigned to do. We were assigned to say, what should they do about cloning? Now, these things are related, so you can understand how they get mixed up. But, you know, as we were narrowing in on our discussion, I kept hearing remarks like, well, how is this going to appeal to Senator Grassley in Iowa and Senator so-and-so in Michigan and some other person that might be of interest in this subject? And then the thing gets muddled up as to what the science is and what the policy is, and what the policy might be from a person interested in science and technology. It may be very different what a policy is for someone who's a senator from Nebraska or New York or wherever it would be, who has all these other considerations to consider. But these committees aren't composed to think about all those other things. We don't have structural engineers to think about infrastructure or other people. And so I think we have to be, it's very difficult, and it comes down to keep the scientific experts or the scholarly experts focused on what they know and not on what they wish or how they would anticipate how what the political reaction might be and so on. And it's, you know, it's understandably not easy to to separate these things, but that's a constant problem. And the closer you get to a controversial issue, the bigger that problem becomes.
So for PCAST then, did you guys have an idea of who, you know, did you have, were you intentional about who you were writing your reports for?
Well, yes, we were writing them, you know, by definition to the president. That's where they went. And then in my view, I should say, I can't speak for everyone else in the committee, that first of all, Bromley was primarily responsible for that communication. We would write it, but in writing it, I thought we had to be cognizant of OMB and its concerns. I thought it was, in my own view, impossible to know what the Congress might think about all these things, given their various priorities and so on. But OMB was critical, because in addition to, the OMB is extremely powerful in budget allocations. And it's true that generally the OMB recommends X and it gets to NIH, they get X plus Y, but everybody knows this in advance. This is a little game everybody plays. Everybody knows what the Congress is gonna have. So in fact, if you study this, you find that the budget, Congress goes through all his meetings and everything else. The budget is very close to what the president recommends in the end, typically. There are differences, but they tend to be small. And so to me, it was the president on OMB. That's what I had in my mind as I was trying to think these problems through. But the way it worked then, and I think effectively, Bromley was our messenger. I mean, our work was a messenger of a certain kind. There was the work, but reports and so on. But then Bromley was really had to take this to OMB and to, and to the president.
I'm curious, you were speaking earlier about being kind of realistic with regarding, you know, the returns on basic research.
Yeah, right.
Did you in PCAST or another, I know you're involved with AAU and AAAS and other, did you find kind of allies in that?
Yes, I found not very many, very hard to find allies in this area. But Ralph Gomery, for example, was an ally. He was very realistic. He had been, as you probably know, head of research at IBM, I guess it was, for many years. Then he was chairman of the Sloan Foundation after that. But so he had a very, very good idea of how new ideas get implemented and get results. So he was head of research at IBM. So he knew something about, and they had a very high quality research. It wasn't quite Bell Labs, but it was a very high quality research operation. He knew how long it took and what transformations took place between someone having a really clever idea in the research department and something happening in a piece of equipment that IBM was dealing with. And so he was very realistic about this, and he was very articulate and very tough minded. And so he had a big influence, I think, on the thinking in PCAST. At least he had a big influence on me, and I think he had a big influence on the others as well.
Thanks. I'm wondering, you mentioned, and I know that you were appointed vice chair at some point. How did your responsibilities change your kind of...
Very little, really. I think David Packer just didn't want to travel quite so much and wasn't really, David Packer was obviously a very accomplished person. I mean, I don't have to say that, enormously accomplished person, built a big company and so on. But I think he was at a stage in his life where he really wasn't either willing or able to really put some of the work in that required the committee to function and function well and stuff get out on time and so on and so forth. I think that was the primary reason. I was never told that, but that was my observation. And so they wanted someone who was going to sort of backstop them in a way. And I think that was, but did my role change a lot? No, it didn't change a lot.
Were there PCAST reports that you know, that stood out to you or writing or?
I'm embarrassed to say I should have gone over all this. And, you know, maybe if you guys can tolerate talking to me again, I would go over all these reports and remind, that's what I should have done. I'm embarrassed to say that I didn't do it. So if you're to ask me right now, no, I can't pick one right now.
That's okay. Yeah, I mean, we would obviously love to speak with you again. And I'm also happy to send you the archives on PCAST if you'd like.
Yeah, I think I'll check it. I think I have copies. At my stage of the game, you're deaccessioning stuff in your library, you know, that you kept all these years. For, you know, I'm really never going to look at that again. I might as well face it. And so I'll have to look and see what why don't you email me your telephone number or just email me your email address. And so if I need to be reminded, I can send you a note. Maybe you can send me some of the stuff. I'll see what I have. I'd have to look. I don't know. I haven't looked at it recently.
No, it's completely fine. One of the interesting things about this project is that speaking with people, you know, it's PCAST is somewhat of a niche, you know, topic.
Put it mildly.
Yeah. So any kind of viewpoint is helpful. But well, this kind of it makes me curious if, you know, since your time on PCAST, if you've, you know, followed their work or had a perspective on what PCAST is.
I did in the immediately following years, but not much since then. And you know, one of the things that happens, unfortunately, when you reach my age, most of the people you work with and have worked with, you know, you either are fully retired or worse. And the, you know, you don't, so I don't sort of keep up as much as I did at one time, when people I still knew were very active in PCAST, people like Charles Vest and so on, were very active following my time on PCAST. But I will commit to sort of looking back on these things. What I don't have, I can probably find in the library here, but so I'm going to try that first before bothering you.
No, it's all good. And well, I guess I was going to ask. Oh, yeah. Before I forget, you had mentioned meeting in the Oval Office and then also Camp David. Did you have a security clearance? Were the meetings open to the public?
Let me see. I'm trying to think when the Open Meetings Act really began to have teeth in it. And I can't quite remember. Of course, near the end, all our meetings were open. For example, of the Bioethics Advisory Commission during the Clinton administration were all open to the public. There were very restricted situations by the time the Clinton administration, restrictive in the sense, open. I mean, that may be a good or bad idea. But certainly at the very beginning, they weren't quite so open. And I'd have to go back and check as to when that change took place. I found the Open Committee not to be a problem, actually, although most of my colleagues thought it was going to be a problem. I never found it to be a problem. So in PCAST, even when we were dealing, I mean, the most controversial issue we dealt with was the simple one, namely the cloning issue, where all kinds of animal rights groups and parents' rights groups and IVF organizations were interested in what on earth we were going to do and so on. Occasionally was a distraction, but mostly it wasn't a distraction. Mostly it was just fine. To be honest with you, the most irksome thing that happened in all these committee meetings is when the government issued a new rule that if you had, say, coffee in the meeting room, okay, where you had public attending, the public couldn't have any of the coffee. It was the most ridiculous possible scheme. I mean, these are people you would hope to build some goodwill with, and you're going to save what? $0.87 for two more cups of coffee and it was so irrational, but nevertheless, that's the most irksome thing I can think of, which is just a trivial thing. But, you know, it was odd. You're sitting there and they're participating. They're speaking at the meetings. They're making presentations. But no, you can't have any of that coffee over there. And that was the most irksome thing I can remember.
It's a little draconian.
It's like what happens in a lot of government regulations. You save a dime here and there, and tens of millions flow out in other ways that you can't see so easily.
Yeah. Well, I'm wondering, so, you know, you had kind of said that the questions haven't changed so much in terms of federal science policy, who gets what and when,
that's
and the divisions between R&D, and basic R, applied R. Mm-hmm. Are you, PCAST is now in its, has a longer history, but in its, I guess, sixth edition in the Biden administration.
There's one thing that very important that's changed.
Mm.
And that is the importance of federal versus corporate research and development. You've looked at this data, I'm sure, many times. The proportion, the federal government's importance keeps declining and corporate importance keeps rising.
Yeah.
If I were in PCAST right now, or if I was asked about what PCAST might think about, there's something that we were thinking through carefully. The data is available. I don't know what the answers would be here, but somebody should be thinking very carefully about what this means for the health of the R&D sector. Now, I just went through a very, I'm going to turn around because I need a report right off my desk, so just excuse me.
Of course.
You probably have seen this report. This is The Perils of Complacency from the American Academy of Arts and Science. It's, I don't know if you can see this.
Yeah, huh?
The members of the committee are a who's who in a certain generation, okay? Slightly younger than I am, not a lot younger than I am. Who's who. I mean, you couldn't have a more distinguished committee making the same old recommendations.
Yeah.
Which in this very report, you can see a graph. I can't put my hands on it right now. It shows corporate versus this is just the executive summary. This thing. I have the full report somewhere here. What's happening to corporate versus, and I don't know of any serious government report that deals with that directly. Does it matter who's doing the R&D? They have different, and I have, well, maybe there are such reports. I mean, I just haven't seen one. And the, that would be a subject, a PCAST person. If I were in PCAST now, I would like to sit back and say, has anybody got any insight on this? Does this matter? Maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe it does matter. I don't know. But it's by far the largest development in kind of the financing of R&D in this country has taken place in the last two decades. I don't know. Since I haven't studied it, I can't say. Anybody's looking for that topic, that's a little different. The topics of this is part of the Baker Institute also, incidentally. This comes out of the Baker Institute and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. So you, Kenny, ought to be familiar with this thing. Norm Augustine has written many such reports. And he's terrific.
Yeah,
he everybody is. On this committee. I mean, look at this committee members. I say, well, you know, this is a who's who in this area. They know more than I know. And, it's the same old argument, which is a good argument. I mean, I think there's a good argument in here, but I ask who is looking at some of the new, or are there any new, arguments to make? And it seems to me that the difference between the, support of the federal government and the support of corporations for R&D is just widened, and maybe it doesn't have any impact. I mean, I haven't studied, I can't say, but I'd be stunned if it has no impact. But, you know, having not studied it, I don't know.
Well, I have an immediate follow-up question, but I should also say full disclosure, I'm the primary staff on this report, right?
Well, you couldn't get a better group of people together.
Yeah, Neil and Norm have really been wonderful, and I learned
Norm Augustine's a fantastic person. I mean, everybody on this committee is a fantastic person. I know virtually every member of this committee, and I couldn't put together a better committee.
Did you overlap? I know that Norm served in some, I know he served in later PCAS, but he was also on some subcommittees during Bush 41's PCAS. Did you guys overlap them?
I don't remember that. I know Norm because he was a member of the board here at Princeton. That's how I got to know him best. Mm-hmm. He was on the board for at least 4 or 5 years while I was president. That's how I got to know him best. And he taught here after he retired. He taught at our engineering school for some years, I don't know how many, on a part-time basis. He came up, I think, a few times a week. But, you know, this is, you must have done a lot of work on this. I mean, this report, the thicker report, reflects a lot of work. And so I'm keeping it to use in my classes.
Great.
So to have that impact, whatever that is, whatever that's worth. But I really think we need some new thinking. Norm could have written this report 10 years ago and it would be right, and 20 years ago and it would be right, and now it's right again, it's still right. So I think anyone interested in this would benefit from looking at this report, but we need, I think, some new thinking as well.
Yeah, I would agree, and I know that maybe Obama's PCAS tried to, I guess, touch this issue of government, industry, university partnerships.
Around a long time. I mean, I remember serving at the National Academy inaugurated this committee of, what do you call it, government, university, business something, round table.
Right, right.
I was on the first version of that. And that was good to have that. But I don't know that it had the hoped for impact.
So what's missing there? I mean, in writing this report, I think, to speak frankly and personally, the recommendation ultimately, if it's going through a large committee process like this has to be kind of, more general, but from your perspective, as a university president of Princeton and Michigan, and what's missing in terms of making stronger, more effective partnerships?
What's missing from this report, or what's missing?
What's not from the report, but what is? Sorry, I'm being not specific, but from what can the government do better to encourage, kind of, industry partnerships, or encourage but more of those types of, a lot of the PCAS.
Well, I have a very particular view of this, and I don't know at all if it's legitimate or not, because I have not, like, I've done a study and study demonstrates something. If a corporation has a problem, they will look for the best possible people to answer that problem. They don't care whether they're in Sweden or they're in Kalamazoo. When they have a problem, they are going to look for the best possible people to answer it, because the problems that they perceived are extremely important to them. So I think that, I know this is not very popular, but I'll say it anyway. I think that if you let the universities do what they do best, and you let the corporations do what they do best, and that's a better strategy than trying to figure out what they can do together. Because communication will flow when it's important. And corporations are always looking for talent. They're always looking for ideas. That's for those that are R&D based in some way, whether it's in the pharmaceutical industry or the chemical industry or whichever industries are R&D based. And so I'm less enthusiastic about let's get together and we'll do all this together than I am about letting corporations do what they do best, let the government do what it does best, and let the universities do what they do best, and then I believe communication will take care of itself. I don't think it's true that communication gets bottled up in universities or it gets bottled up in corporations. This stuff all gets out. So I'm not against communications or against joint projects, which are identified and seem to be very useful to both sides. I'm entirely in favor of that. But I don't think we can engineer that so easily. So you have to hope, and the model I have in my head, and I know it's not very popular, but the model I have in my head is when individuals in our electrical engineering department recognize a subject which they can't solve by themselves, they need some corporate help to do it, because there's assets and corporations that universities don't have. It might be equipment, it might be persons. They know where to go and get it done. And the same is true the other way around. So I'm not against, how can one be against cooperation? I mean, one can only be in favor of it. But I think the primary focus, I mean, you know, what does universities do well? And what do corporations do well? And what does government do well? And then go from there. That's just my view. I don't think it's a commonly held view, but anyhow.
Well, yeah, I think, certainly going against the grain, especially in these committees, seems important.
How did you enjoy your time on this committee?
I learned so much from Neil and Norm. I really
You got two very good people.
Yeah. It was kind of a fascinating also to get a picture for how the American Academy works.
Yeah.
And all the people that are involved in that.
Yeah, I know less about that. Yeah. Well, I hope you enjoyed it at least.
I did. And I think it also has been very, very interesting to watch Neil and Norm work on the Hill.
Norm is great at that.
He
has a great reputation.
Yeah. It's been sitting in on these meetings with Congress folks and their staff has been really enlightening.
There's a lesson
about what Congress people know personally.
Well, but you know, Norm has a very unusual background, as you know. He's he has credibility in the corporate sector. He has credibility in the government sector. He has credibility in the academic sector. He's a very unusual person. So that's great. I'm glad you had a chance to work with him. You're very lucky.
Yeah, I do feel very lucky. Mm-hmm. And he's not short on wisdom, and he also is very generous with his time and
great.
What he passes along. So we've kind of gotten off the oral history track.
I'm sorry.
but it's my fault. I mean, I'm curious, and of course, part of this is that you know all these folks, and I'm curious about your relationships with them.
Yeah. Well, you know, Neil, let's see, I'd have forgotten what years he was most active in Washington. I mean, Norm has been out there forever and for various reasons, not all of which relate to what we're talking about. But, I have to say that the people, I said it before, people on this committee, you couldn't possibly have had people with more experience or more distinction than the people on this committee. It was a who's who of a certain generation, I have to say, but nevertheless, a certain generation. Obviously they had a lot of very interesting things to say. Who was most active on the committee outside of Neil and Norm? I'm asking you questions instead of running around, but all right. That's what I'll ask.
I will say the best comments and most kind of thorough comments we got on the earliest drafts were Jeanette Wing.
Mm-hmm.
She was just fantastic, I thought, and really dug into stuff.
Yeah.
And then also Steve Chu was very responsive.
Enormous amount of experience, yeah.
Yeah.
Scientist in addition, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyways, lucky you. You're very lucky to work with such a distinguished group. I'm not going to ask any more questions, make any more statements.
No.
I'm keeping you too long on this call.
No, we're keeping you. Norm is giving a talk with the Baker Institute on Wednesday, so I can send you a Zoom invite for that if you're curious, with John Hennessy at
I know John. Yeah. Okay.
Well, I will, now that we're chatting, I guess I want to pass it back over to Dave to see if he has any kind of follow-up questions. I know we're kind of running short on time.
I don't have any questions specifically. And you know, if you're okay with coming back to talk about some of the reports specifically, then I think if there are any questions that we do think of.
Okay. You're talking about the PCAS reports?
Yeah.
Okay.
That might be.
Try to get hold of those. I think I have them. I don't know, but I think I have them all, and I'll check it out.
Sure.
Well, yeah, Dr. Shapiro, what I'll do is I'll email you my email so you have as well as this event, and that way you can ping me if you have any.
Yeah, sure. I will do that. Okay. Well, I hope I haven't misused your time. In any case, good luck with this project. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right.
So, thank you.
Okay.
Have a good evening.
The uncomfortable part of these meetings is when you leave it, you just blank everybody out all of a sudden. It's very odd. You know, it's not like when you meet people, you sort of take them to a door or something. Now you're just here and then gone. So apologize. I'm going to click the leave part of the screen, and just please call me back or get in touch in any way for anything that can be helpful.
Thank you.
Okay,
thank you.
All right.
That was good. I mean, I don't feel like we were missing a whole lot of stuff. Are we still recording? Let's stop recording.
Oh, yeah. I'm on my phone.